Some of you heard what Brother Rick said when he was introducing the fact that we would have the ladies' lesson. He said, Sarah Fallis is going to preach to the ladies. And I nudged my husband and I said, I think I'm going to say that. Years ago when I was first had an opportunity to speak at a ladies' day, there was an announcement in a church bulletin, and it said Sarah Fallis will bring the lesson. And my grandfather, who had been an elder in the church for several years and who had always been an encouragement to me, said, why is it that we say when a woman does it, she brings a lesson, but when a man does it, we say he preached? And I thought, I don't know. But today I'm going to bring a lesson, and I may even shift into the gear of preaching a little bit, if that's all right. I don't know any other way to do it. I do bring you greetings from the ladies' Bible class that meets on Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock at the Bridgewood Congregation in East Fort Worth. This group of ladies has been so special to me. They've allowed me for about 2 years to be their teacher, and they have challenged me to study by their knowledge of the Word. I tell them that I feel like I'm teaching beginning algebra to people who can do calculus. They are a very knowledgeable group of women, but they have also encouraged me through their love and their support, and they're with me today. You don't see them, but I know that they are here through their prayers and through their love. But we are looking today at a lesson, coping with material loss in this world. You turn on your television, you open your newspaper, and words like tsunami, hurricanes, tornadoes, wildfires, WorldCom, Enron, energy costs, plant closings, downsizing, outsourcing, crop failures, market downturns, 9/11, terrorism, suicide bombings, war, hijacking. And we see material loss played out in our living rooms. That tells us material loss is a fact of life. And God doesn't put a bubble around Christians and protect us from all of these kinds of things as we live in this world. As I was preparing the final draft for this lesson, I received an email from our daughter. Her best friend had been up all night watching his apartment burn. And she says, I'd forgotten you were working on that material loss paper. This really hits close to home. It's easy to be desensitized about it until you really think what it's like to stand outside and watch everything you own and the place you lived in go up in flames. And Tanya's right. Sometimes we see so much that it can become impersonal to us. But material loss can hit home. And it is personal. And it's an emotional loss too. And we'll be talking about that tomorrow. But I know that material loss, when we look at those things, it's just stuff, isn't it? But isn't it stuff that we have attached meaning to? Perhaps you have something very special, an heirloom piece of furniture, or something that belonged to your grandmother or to your mother, and you treasure that. And then we have things that our children have given us. And I have a little Melmac plate that has a Christmas tree and an Indian teepee on it, and I could never replace that. And you have things like that, too. And is it any wonder that my daughter's an archaeologist for the state of New Mexico? But you see, we have things that we have attached meaning to. But since material loss is a fact of life, then we need to ask the question, what should be our attitude toward material things? And as we answer that question, we'll be answering the question of this lesson, how do we cope with material loss? I have a little rock in my office, and I keep it on the desk there to remind me of something. You see, I go to Tanzania, East Africa, every summer with Gary, and we teach there and help the church in Eastern Africa near Mount Kilimanjaro. And there were two women that I had a Bible study with 2 summers ago, and they were especially grateful to have a job. Many people there do not have jobs. They just barely exist as far as we would be concerned. But they showed me where they worked, and they worked in this huge rock quarry, and their job was to take these large rocks and to sit with a hammer and pound them into little pieces of gravel that could be used to pave roads or to make concrete. And they were just thankful to have a job. I picked up that rock and put it on my desk to remind me how blessed I am and how rich I am compared to so many people in other parts of the world. And I don't say that to put any of us on a guilt trip, but just to help us keep things in perspective. You and I, as Americans, are rich. We are richly blessed. We live in a land where we have air-conditioned malls, we have fancy strip shopping centers, and Madison Avenue-style advertising grabs our attention almost every moment of the day. You open up your newspaper, and it's 90% ads, isn't it? It creates in us a desire for more and more and more and more. And we are discontent. We snatch, we grab, we insure, we worry, we're unhappy, we're depressed. And in a recent article in the Christian Chronicle, I believe it was Stephen Griggs, who called the money problems that we have in our families due to this escalating personal debt. He called that the great secret sin of the church. You see, our abundance has not brought happiness, and it really has the potential to pull us away from God. So as we think about coping with material loss, perhaps we need to think about how we replaced Christian stewardship with the American dream. We need to get back to what the Bible says about material things and about stewardship. And the first thing that the Bible declares to us about material things is that God owns everything. And you and I are only stewards of what belongs to Him. Life is stewardship. Whether you live in America, Asia, Africa, Europe, and that's true for the Christian and the non-Christian alike. We are all going to give an account before God. God is the sole owner of everything. The Bible declares that early on. In fact, in Genesis chapter 14, Melchizedek called God possessor of heaven and earth. And Moses told the people as they came into the promised land, "Behold, the heaven of heavens is the Lord's thy God. The earth also with all that therein is," in Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 14. And we're all familiar with Psalm chapter 14, verse 1. "The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world, and they that dwell therein." If the earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, then we need to understand how we are to manage what He has given to us. You know, when God brought Israel into the land of Canaan, He gave them some special instructions about the land. In Leviticus 25, verse 23, He said, "The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, and you are strangers and sojourners with me." And as I was reading from Brother Homer Haley, as he commented on this, he said, God would teach Israel that they were only possessors or stewards of that which belonged to Jehovah. The land was His. And to impress that lesson, He gave the laws of the sabbatical year, the jubilee, the tithes, the offerings, and the gleanings. They must learn that they were active managers of what belonged to another. And you know, many godly people in the Bible were wealthy. We think of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, but they knew they were managers of what God had given them. They knew that this world was not their home. And the Hebrew writer tells us that they confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims in this earth. And they declared that they were seeking a better country. We think, too, of people in the New Testament like Barnabas and Lydia, who were also wealthy. Barnabas sold his property so that he could help in the advancement of the gospel. And Lydia was generous and hospitable. You see, they knew they were stewards of what belonged to another. But as I was thinking about this lesson, I wondered if we in America really understand stewardship. I wondered if I understand stewardship. Like Israel, do we need to be taught that we are managers of what belongs to another? You know, ownership is the thing in America, isn't it? You must own your home. You must own your car. Ownership, even to the point of serious personal debt, is the thing in America. That's the American way of life. But the system of stewardship was common in the ancient world. And you know that many of Jesus' parables use that scenario. And I was thinking about the parable of the talents. That's one that we're all very familiar with. But have we learned the lesson of stewardship there? Jesus said in Matthew 25, verse 14, "The kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling into a far country, who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods." Now notice, Jesus is clear with this. You can't misunderstand it. The goods belonged to the master, and he entrusted those goods to his servants. It was the servant's responsibility to take care of the master's property. And it was the master's responsibility to take care of his servants. So the servants had to trust the master to take care of them. Now, as stewards, yes, we are to provide for our families. What does Paul say? If we don't provide for our families, we've denied the faith and are worse than an infidel. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8. And as stewards, we are to be good managers and look toward the future and provide for our families. Remember the woman in Proverbs 31? She was commended because she managed her resources and her household well. She used forethought and wisdom to provide for her family. So when the whole of Bible teaching is considered concerning stewardship, we have a balanced picture. We are to seek to be independent and to pay our debts, and to provide a home and opportunity for our family, and to provide for the future. But to evaluate everything in terms of money can only be the most perilous of sins. So we need to be careful in America today, and in the church today, that we not use those scriptures, though, to rationalize our selfishness or our inordinate pursuit of wealth. We may think sometimes that we are to use God's blessings well, that we are to make good investments so that we can retire and play in our retirement. For after all, we deserve that. Now, God does desire that we enjoy His blessings, doesn't He? In 1 Timothy chapter 6, and in fact we'll be turning to that in a few minutes to get some other lessons from that, but in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 17, there, Paul says, "Command those who are rich in the present world not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God." And notice what he says, "in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy." God wants us to enjoy the things that he has given to us. But there's a difference in enjoying God's blessings and in greed and selfishness. And we need to guard against that, because our American society today is so gives us the message of amass for me, have for me, more and more and more and more. Jesus said, though, that we are to seek His kingdom. You see, we are to use what God has entrusted to us in order to increase God's business, and God's business is His kingdom. So Jesus said in Matthew 6:33, "Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven and His righteousness, and all these things that we need in this life, will be added unto us." And in Matthew chapter 6, prior to that, he tells us not to worry about food or clothing or to be overly anxious about all of those things. He said, after those things, the Gentiles seek. The Gentiles, as Jesus used that term, were people of the world who did not know and honor God. So I want you to substitute the word worldly people and think for a few minutes. Let's listen to our conversation. Is our conversation dominated by things? Perhaps that dream home you're building or you're redecorating, or are the crafts that you've just purchased or made, or that antique show you went to recently, or the dishes you collect? After all these things worldly people seek. Notice the contrast in verse 32. Worldly people seek things and talk about things. God's people, in verse 33, seek His kingdom. And if we seek His kingdom, then our conversation will be dominated by things relating to God's kingdom. God supplies our needs so that we're not encumbered with all of these things, and we can seek His kingdom first. Jesus, though, does not elevate poverty, and He does not degrade material wealth and condemn material wealth. But Jesus asks us to realize the nature of material things, the seductive nature of material things. He says, beware of covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses, in Luke chapter 12, verse 15. So our attitude toward material things should be that we are stewards of what God has given us and of what God owns. And then I want you to look at some things in 1 Timothy chapter 6 as Paul instructs Timothy to instruct others regarding material wealth. Got to get a little water here. First of all, in this chapter, Paul is discussing those who are false teachers and who are not teaching a doctrine that is in accordance with godliness. And he goes on to say in verse 5 that those false teachers suppose that godliness is a means of gain. They suppose that godliness is a means of gain. Do you know some that are perhaps like that, supposing godliness to be a means of gain? You might first of all think of TV evangelists, you know, that godliness is a means of gain for them. But then I think when we go to Tanzania and others who have been to India and other third world countries have said that we need to be careful that we not make rice Christians. And by that I mean that some in those countries will desire to be baptized just to make life better for them. Some even want to be preachers so they can get American dollars, so they can live a little better. But before we condemn them, maybe we should look at ourselves and see if we don't have a similar thing, just dressed in different cultural clothing. Do you know preachers who decide what to preach and perhaps where to preach based on the salary? Do you know those who maybe have quit preaching because they just couldn't make enough money to keep up with that wife that liked all of those things? And I know that I'm probably speaking to some of the preacher student wives here at the Southwest School of Preaching, and perhaps some young preacher's wives. And for 15 years, I taught the preacher's wives program at the Brown Trail School of Preaching. And one thing that I stressed over and over again is that we not get our lives so wrapped up in things and in the things that we think we must have. You know that, and it's easy for us to do that because we're the homemakers and we want our home to look nice, don't we? So we like to decorate it. And I noticed that even in Africa, in mud huts, they would cut pictures out of magazines or newspapers to have on the wall, something to decorate the home. Now, one of the missionary wives told me that there was a Christian couple that had Gary's picture on the wall in their bedroom, and I kept wondering about that. How is that making their... But don't we do, we have a lot of things that we like to do. We like our environment to be more beautiful, don't we? But it's easy to get caught up in all of that if we're not careful. And my mother was telling me, though, and you know, mothers try to keep us on the straight and narrow all the time. And I was telling her what I was teaching to the student wives, and she said, well, you sure have a lot of stuff. And I said, yes, Mother, I have some stuff. But I said, there's a line right under that. I said, God knows my heart. And he knows that there's not any of that stuff all put together that would stand between me and serving him. That I would give up all that stuff. I collect oriental art. I like those things. But I would give it all up if that's what it took to continue to be faithful to God. And I'm not saying that to brag, because I know there are many people here, many of you feel exactly the same way, but we need to constantly remind ourselves of that. So I would challenge you who are young preachers' wives, don't make your husband a rice preacher. Don't make them have to make that choice between making a payment on that dream home that you so desired and in standing for the truth of God. About 12 years ago, Gary and I purchased a house in North Richland Hills. And we had decided how much money we wanted to spend on the house. And that was it. We wouldn't look at anything that costs more, because, you know, after you've looked at a $100,000 house, it's hard to be satisfied with that $80,000 house, you know, and so on. So we knew that, and we just put a cutoff mark, and that was it. When we finally decided on the house that we live in right now, we were filling out the loan papers, and the real estate agent was shocked. She said, you could have bought 3 or 4 times this house. And we said, we know. We just didn't want to. This house is adequate. It meets our needs. It's what we can use. We didn't want to type everything in that house. And I don't say that again to brag. I'm saying that's a lesson that we've learned over all these years of living. If you haven't learned something that you can share with others. But as preachers' wives, we do need to be careful. And an older preacher's wife told me years ago, about 30-something years ago, she said, a preacher's wife's dreams ought to always be portable. A preacher's wife's dreams ought to always be portable. And they really should. And the best kind of dreams are portable enough that they take you into eternity, not those that hold you here. So let's take care that we have our hearts set on serving God. And that's what Paul is saying to Timothy. Then, as he says in chapter 6, verse 6, now godliness with contentment is great gain. You see, godliness, when it's coupled with contentment, does have great value. But contentment is one of those things that goes against our American nature, isn't it? As we noticed in the introduction, our advertisers are constantly trying to make us discontent, so we'll do what? Go out and buy more, right? We have to be made to be discontent to buy. But it also goes against our history, doesn't it? Didn't we settle the West because we wanted to know what was out there? We were discontent with being just in one place. Didn't we go to the moon because we wanted to know what was out there? Didn't we invent so many things to make life better because we were discontent? Well, you see, Paul isn't talking about being complacent. He isn't talking about a lack of initiative, but he is talking about learning contentment with the things that we have. In Philippians 4, verses 11 and 12, he says, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. You see, we must learn contentment. It doesn't come naturally. It didn't come naturally in the first century. It doesn't come naturally in Tanzania. It doesn't come naturally here in America. We must learn to be content. And you know, when we look at life through the prism of eternity, we will perhaps stop striving for more and more and more. You see, it never hurts to be reminded of the old saying that there are no pockets in a shroud and you don't see U-Haul trailers behind a hearse. We can learn contentment if we learn to value what we have instead of what we don't have. And also, perhaps learning to simplify our lives just a bit. A few years ago, I found a book that kind of caught my attention, and it was on the sale table at Barnes & Noble, so that caught my attention also. It was called How to Handle 1,000 Things at Once. It's by Don Aslett. And some of you may feel like you need to know how to handle 1,000 things at once. And he had some really good time-saving tips and managing tips in there. But one of the things that really stood out to me was he talked about how much time and effort and energy we spend managing, and this was his word, our junk, our stuff. And he was talking about how important it is to simplify your life. And there's one thing that he said that I thought was interesting. He said, before you exhaust yourself in an effort to find and own all those frills, be advised that luxury is the worst kind of thing to tend. It makes you pay more interest in insurance. It calls for more coddling, for more space, and more precautions. Even if you're rich, you can't afford luxury, he said, because of the time it takes. And you know, I've thought about that. And I've tried really to simplify my life by getting rid of some of those things that take my time away from the study of the Word, that take my time away from the teaching of the Word. And I've been able to do that to some degree. Every time we have a short break, one of my teacher friends will say, what are you going to do? And I'm usually say, well, I'm cleaning out some of my stuff and going to throw it away. And I've been doing that for 2 or 3 years. She said, Sarah, don't you have it all cleaned out yet? Well, you know, I just keep going through it and say, can I do away with this? Can I do away with that? And every time we go to Tanzania and come home, I'm saying, can I get rid of some more of this stuff? Because you see, our stuff does take our time and it can take our attention away from the things that are important. But it's difficult, isn't it? It's still hard for me to pass up a clearance rack in Foley's, you know? It's just difficult to do that. But we need to train ourselves to think in terms of those things. Notice what Paul says in verse 8 of chapter 6. He says, having food and clothing, let us then be content. Other versions translate that, having food and shelter or food and covering. Let us be content. You see, all we need in this realm is food, clothing, and shelter. Isn't that really all we need? And Paul says if we have that, let's be content. And you know, one thing that Don Aslett said that I thought was kind of amusing, he said, why do you look through all these sale brochures and everything like that? Why do you do all this window shopping? He said, if you needed it, wouldn't you know it? You know, we would know it. But again, it's feeding that want, isn't it? That desire that we have many times for more and more. And that's what Paul is saying. If you needed it, you would know it. Paul also addresses a group of people here, those who would desire to be rich. Those who would desire to be rich. In verses 9 and 10, he says that those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. That's the idea of dragging you to the bottom. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. A love of money, a going after money is a root of all kinds of evil. And you know, women who really desire wealth, their house is never going to be big enough. Their clothes are never going to be fine enough. Their car is never going to be new enough. They're always going to have more and more and more. And they're going to push their husbands to get them to have more and more and more. You see, possessions have a way of possessing us if we're really not careful. If you read in Deuteronomy chapter 6, and you're familiar with this, but if you want to turn to it in chapter 6, verses 10 through 12, where Moses instructs the people that when you come into the land and you have these homes and these beautiful cities that you didn't have to build, and these houses that are full of goods that you didn't have to fill, and you have wells and vineyards and so on, beware. Beware lest you forget the Lord. You see, riches and possessions have that seductive nature and they can move us away from God. So we need to beware. Riches have always come with a warning. I think about Ezekiel chapter 16, where God there in that chapter describes his relationship with Israel. And he said, I found you as just a dirty, naked baby lying by the side of the road about to die. And I took you, and I washed you, and I gave you food, and I helped you grow. I gave you fine clothing, and you grew into a beautiful young woman. And I gave you jewels, and I gave you the finest of things, and I caused you to prosper. And everyone who looked admired your beauty. And God says of her beauty, it was perfect through my comeliness, which I put upon thee, says the Lord God. In Ezekiel 16, verse 14, but in verse 15, he continues, and he said, but thou didst trust in thine own beauty. You see, Israel began to trust in themselves and in what they had done. And many times we in America today and in the church today can forget that all of this bounty that we enjoy comes from God. And we may then have great difficulty when we experience material loss. The tinsel and the glitter of this world can easily deceive us. Charles Wendell made this statement, if you're not very careful, you'll find yourself caught in a vortex of greed that will inevitably lead to your destruction. Materialism is a killer, at best a crippler. Fight against it as you would a pack of hungry wolves. I wish I'd said it that way. Fight against materialism. But again, materialism is a lot of times difficult for us to define. I remember hearing Brother Avon Malone as he was speaking about materialism. He said, sweet little luxury, don't you cry. You'll be a necessity by and by. And isn't that so true? You can look around. I look around in my house, and my daughter was not quite that sweet about it. She said, Mother, I just think it's interesting that you have a lot of things now that you used to say was a luxury and having materialism, you know. And all. Our kids have a way of putting things in focus. But materialism is something that we need to guard against. And if we don't, then we will have great difficulty when we suffer material loss. So Jesus warns us that no man can serve two masters. He'll either hate the one and love the other, or he'll hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon, or you cannot serve God and money or material things. And that's true. We cannot serve God and material things. But we can, if we are good stewards, serve God with material things. And that's what Paul continues to say in chapter 6 of 1 Timothy and in verse 17. He said, command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in their riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them do good, that they may be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. So Paul exhorts those who are rich. And there were wealthy people in the church in the first century, just as there are wealthy people in the church today. But Paul charges them not to be conceited because of their wealth. Again, to remember that it is God who gives us the ability or the power to get wealth. And then he admonishes them not to trust in that uncertain wealth, because wealth is fleeting. It's subject to the natural decay, to the ebb and flow of financial markets, to natural disasters, oil reserves, war and terrorism and thefts. And that's what Jesus meant when he said, lay not up for yourselves treasures on this earth where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal, in Matthew 6, 19. And then Paul admonishes those who are wealthy to do good with their wealth. You see, wealth is just a great responsibility. And we can use it to enrich ourselves. And if we do so, we impoverish our souls. Or we can use our wealth to help bring comfort and help to others, to send the gospel into all the world, and by doing so and becoming perhaps poorer materially, we become richer spiritually. You see, it's still more blessed to give than to receive. And notice here in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 19, that Paul says that those who do good with their wealth are storing up for themselves treasures of a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. Does that remind you also of what Jesus said when he was talking about where to place our treasures? He said, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Now, what does all this talk about wealth, materialism, and stewardship have to do with how to cope with material loss? It has everything to do with it. You see, material loss is a fact of life. It has come into some of your lives. It may come in the future into our lives. We do not know. It can be devastating, but it can only be devastating for a time. The greater loss, the truly greater loss, is spiritual. And Jesus said that in Matthew 16, verse 26, for what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world but lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? You see, God has not promised to shield Christians from material losses, but he has promised to take care of those basic needs. And that's what he meant, what Jesus meant in Matthew chapter 6. In Matthew chapter 6, verses 20 and 21, Jesus gives a real simple key to coping with emotional loss. It's so simple, and yet it's hard to make application many times. But it's simply this: what is the address of your treasures? Is the address of your treasures 161 Wall Street, New York, New York, USA? Or is the address of your treasures 1000 Golden Street, Heavenly Jerusalem? That makes the difference. You see, God has richly blessed us, and he's instructed us to be stewards of his bounty. In doing so, we need to be prudent that we don't buy into that American dream of have more, get more, buy now with no payments or interest until 2010. We need to learn to be content, to use our wealth in his business to increase his kingdom. Ladies, you and I know that we live in uncertain and troubling times. September 11th, 2001 is etched indelibly in our memories. But perilous times have always confronted us. I've heard family stories of World War II and how many items were rationed, and how mothers went to bed not knowing if their sons and daughters were okay. I remember the fallout shelters. Boy, I'm old. And I remember threats of nuclear war, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Vietnam War, the Cold War, the Berlin Wall. And now we have the Iraqi war, the Middle East crisis, OPEC, terrorism, and bioterrorism. But as Christians, we need to keep focused on those true riches, on God's kingdom that cannot be shaken. And let us truly pray for peace, not so we can continue to prosper in America, but so that we can help the gospel go through all the world. And let's use our wealth to help tell the world of saving grace and make it known in every place. And let's depend on God and trust him. You'll learn a little bit about me in the next lesson that I love the Old Testament prophets. But one that I love very much is Habakkuk, because he questions. He wonders. He thinks. He's trying to figure things out. And I identify with him. And he lived in perilous and uncertain times just shortly before Nebuchadnezzar's army destroyed Jerusalem. And he was trying to figure things out. But he ends his book with this statement. And it's a faith to which I'm trying to grow, and I hope it's a faith to which you're trying to grow. In Habakkuk chapter 3, the last few verses, he says, although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall there be fruit in the vines, the labor of the olive shall fail, and the fields shall yield no meat, the flock shall be cut off from the fold,
and there shall be no herd in the stalls. And he doesn't say, I'll just grin and bear it, I'll just trust the Lord, I'll just try to get through it. No, he says this. He says, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. Even if I don't have anything, and I don't have the hope of getting anything, I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord is my strength, and He will make my feet like hinds' feet. He will make me to walk upon the high places. And in days when we face material loss, we need to rejoice in the Lord.